The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
For the last 20 plus years, we've been talking in various international fora, the UN and other places, about norms that we would want to see in cyberspace. But we have not been willing to enforce those norms and hold nations accountable when they cross those red lines. And that's what it's all about, in my view. It's really making it very clear what we find acceptable and not acceptable, and hammering people hard, whether it's Russia or China, when they cross those red lines. In my view, SolarWinds does not, you know, merit that strong response because they did not cross a red line. They executed an operation that the U.S. intelligence community would love to execute against the Russians or the Chinese.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 16th, 2021. Dmitry Alperovich is the executive chairman of Silverado Policy Accelerator, and he's the co-founder and former chief technology officer at CrowdStrike. With Ian Ward, he is the author of the recent article on Lawfare entitled, How Should the U.S. Respond to the SolarWinds and Microsoft Exchange Hacks? He joined me in the virtual jungle studio for a discussion of the article and the hacks. How were they similar to one another? And how were they different? Why is it that the SolarWinds hack has received so much more attention than the much more damaging Microsoft Exchange hack? And most important, should the U.S. come down hard on Russia for its activities, or should it go easy on the Russians? Alperovich has interesting answers to all of these questions. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 16th. Dmitry Alperovich on SolarWinds and Microsoft Exchange. So let's start with just an account of these two hacks. You know, I think most people know the word SolarWind and may have some kind of sense that Microsoft Exchange servers have a problem. But for the listener who has put his or her head in the proverbial sand over the last couple months on this stuff, how would you describe the two incidents about which you were writing this week?
Sure. So both incidents look similar on the surface, but actually are very, very different when you start looking into the details. One incident, of course, originated from Russia, Russian intelligence service, the SVR, which is the successor to the KGB. The other is believed to have originated from China, actors that are likely affiliated with the Ministry of State Security, MSS there. Let's start with SolarWinds. So SolarWinds is sort of a classic supply chain hack, right? The target of the hack was not SolarWinds or even some of the other companies that have been compromised in the same fashion, like FireEye or Microsoft and others. The target ultimately was government agencies. This was traditional espionage. The Russians wanted to do what the Russians always want to do, which is gain access to sensitive U.S. secrets, such as the Treasury Department, the Department of Justice, the agency that manages our nuclear weapons and the like, the types of things that no one would be shocked to find out the Russians are trying to get into. But they realize that those can be hard targets. They have relatively good security by and large. So the way to get into them, and more importantly, to stay in them, not just do a quick smash and grab campaign, but really get into it for months, if not years, and continuously steal everything, is to do a very, very stealthy operation where you can compromise software like SolarWinds, introduce a backdoor into that software, wait until everyone updates to that version of software with a backdoor, and then you can use that backdoor as your way into the organization. Of course, you'll have some collateral impact when you do something like this, because you have no way of knowing who is going to get that backdoor. And sure enough, in this particular situation, when they hacked into SolarWinds, when they introduced this backdoor into their code, over 18,000 organizations around the world received that update and ultimately called home to the servers controlled by the Russians to let them know that they're available for compromise. The Russians, however, were very selective and targeted. And that's one of the points I make in the Lawfare piece, is that they shut down, voluntarily shut down their access to 99% of the victims. They were not in this realm of government agencies that they were interested in, or other sort of daisy chain supply chain companies like Microsoft and FireEye and others that you could compromise so you could get into their customers, right? As a result, they were left with only a few hundred victims that they were really interested in, and then they went in and stayed in there for many months until their ultimate discovery. So very much alike to the illegals program, if the listeners remember those, that the Russians have been running for over 100 years. The Show of the Americans was, of course, famously based on that, where they're sending these sleeper cells into countries like the United States under fake identities. They embed themselves into our society and try to get to close to people in power. But these are long-running operations designed to last decades so that you can continuously collect intelligence. That's exactly what they're trying to do in the cyber realm with these operations. The Chinese one is actually very different when you look at their details. So it started out as a traditional intelligence operations targeting think tanks and dissidents that you would expect the Chinese Communist Party to want to go after. They found these vulnerabilities in Microsoft Exchange, so they did not introduce backdoors. They simply looked at the product, discovered vulnerabilities, or somehow learned about those vulnerabilities, and started compromising Microsoft Exchange servers, which are mail servers used commonly by enterprises, and started to pilfer emails and other information from those compromised networks. That was all fine. That was all traditional espionage until a few months later in late February, when somehow, we still don't quite yet know how, the Chinese have gotten wind that Microsoft was going to release a patch that would close down these vulnerabilities. And as a result, they would lose their ability to compromise new victims using these techniques. And what they did then was quite unprecedented, reckless, and I argue dangerous, which is they decided to scan virtually the entire internet for any vulnerable Exchange server, regardless of who may operate it. And they compromised them all, sort of cast a huge net, and then started to see what shakes out and which of the compromised victims they would actually want to look at. The trouble is that the way they went about compromising them is by installing a little piece of code called the web shell on those Exchange servers, which can let other people potentially into those networks, not the Chinese actors, but ransomware crews, other criminal groups, other nation states, and further compromise those networks. And that's what makes it so different from the Russian operation, which was in some ways like a scalpel going in to do a very specific surgery. This was analogous to a full limb amputation.
All right. So I would venture the guess that the amount of coverage devoted to SolarWinds is a sort of order of magnitude higher than the coverage devoted to the Microsoft Exchange server attack. And some of that, I think, has to do with the fact that the name SolarWinds is cooler than the name Microsoft Exchange server, and a good name always helps. But some of it is that a lot of people in government, in Congress, and were genuinely alarmed by the SolarWinds attack. And yet your account of it makes it seem not benign, because it is a well-executed traditional attack designed to, you know, compromise U.S. interests that successfully did so, but much more of the sort of regular order kind of stuff than the Microsoft Exchange attack. And so my question is that a function of the technical sophistication being high? Is it a function of the fact that we think of the Russians as 10 feet tall because of other matters? Is it a function of the, you know, sort of caprice of journalism? Why do people seem so much more alarmed by the SolarWinds attack than the Microsoft Exchange attack?
Yeah, I agree with you, Ben. They definitely are. I think there are a number of reasons for that. One is probably just a function of timing, that SolarWinds was first in terms of us learning about it. So we tend to be preoccupied with things that sort of are new and blaze new ground. Microsoft Exchange seems in many eyes just more of the same for those people that are not paying attention. So that's probably part of it. Two, Russia is always sexier to talk about. You know, we spent the last 4 years talking about Russia nonstop. So anytime Russia is involved in doing anything to the United States, everyone's ears immediately perk up. But three, and I think this is probably the one that makes the most sense from, you know, explaining this disparity, is that from a national security perspective, there's no question that the Russian operation was many times more impactful, right? The targets that they went after, the Justice Department, Treasury, and other agencies, we will be suffering from the compromises of that information for many years to come. There's zero doubt about that. The Chinese, aside from their kind of NGOs, think tank targeting, you know, in this particular situation, really made the sort of economic backbone of this country, the small businesses, the school districts, the small hospitals and the like, more vulnerable, but not, you know, major U.S. government agencies, not, you know, our, you know, most precious national security secrets. So the target set is very different and the implications to the country are very different as a result.
And do you think that that is reflected in sort of people in government who have responsibility for the security of government agencies may be aware at an intellectual level that exposing, you know, the whole world to ransomware attacks is a really bad thing, but it's kind of not in their immediate task set to, you know, protect the world against ransomware, whereas they are sort of tasked with protecting the Treasury Department against espionage.
No question about it. You had many agencies that were for weeks really not using their email because they were in fear that the Russians were reading everything that they were sending, and they had to use classified networks to communicate, which is not easy when everyone's working from home and doesn't have access to a SCIF. So there was a real operational impact on the government. There was obviously sensitive data that was taken, and in many cases, we still don't fully know, and perhaps we'll never know the full extent of the data that was taken. And, you know, the first job of the government is to protect itself. So there's no question that as you're mobilizing government resources, there's lots of them to do, for them to do in responding to the SolarWinds hack. And as you point out, there's not a whole lot for them to actually do in response to the Microsoft Exchange hack, except, you know, urge everyone to patch, as Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, did on Twitter about a week ago, and issue other types of public communications to, you know, small businesses out there that are still running on-premise Exchange and have not patched. You know, to the extent that there is a role for the government going forward, it's really to think through how do you start enforcing red lines, how do you respond to the Chinese for this reckless act, and that's where things can get pretty interesting.
Okay, so I'm going to come to response in a moment, but I want to ask one other question about the nature of the hack first. You say in your piece that these web shells persist even after the servers are patched. And so if you're a medium-sized business running a Microsoft Exchange server, is there really anything you can do at this point? Or, I mean, you do everything Microsoft tells you, you patch the system, okay, but are you still going to get hit with a ransomware attack from Moldova 3 months from now?
That's a great question, Ben. I actually issued a tweet on this last week, which was a little bit provocative, but I think really holds a lot of merit these days. If you have not patched, really not even by now, but by mid of last week, patching was pretty much pointless because if you had a internet-facing exchange server that was vulnerable to these vulnerabilities, someone, maybe the Chinese, maybe other actors that have started exploiting that vulnerability by then, was surely able to compromise you by that point. So what you should have been doing at that point is taking your server offline and either, in the ideal world, migrated to a cloud-based email service like Office 365 or Google that was not vulnerable to these attacks. Or, you know, if for whatever reason you really insisted on running your own email infrastructure, set up a completely new server, rebuild Exchange, patched it, put it in place. But that old server you should treat as completely compromised. So just patching it doesn't actually solve the problem at this point.
All right, let's talk about response. So I think the instinct inside the government is to come down very hard on Russia for SolarWinds and sort of to pack into that response, a whole lot of latent response to past infractions over the last few years. So before we get to the question of whether that is a correct policy or not, and of course you argue in your piece that it is not, do you agree with me that there's a sort of SolarWinds fight that is kind of part of the ether right now?
I think there's a lot of domestic pressure to do something about SolarWinds, and I think you're right. The trends seem to be going down the direction you suggest. I don't think it's all over, but you know, certainly the scales are weighted heavily towards that solution.
All right. So, what does a throw everything at them? This is not the straw that broke the camel's back, but the sledgehammer that broke the camel's back, and they've got to pay a price response look like? Is it a massive set of new sanctions? Is it a response in the cyber domain? Is it both? So when you talk about heading off an intemperate response, what sort of response are you thinking of?
Well, I think the type of response that they're considering are sanctions, which I think at this point have been exhausted as a valuable tool to signal the Russians. They've already been sanctioned up to the hill since 2014. Incremental sanctions are actually not adding much of any benefit in terms of creating additional pain for them. In fact, we're at the point where we're starting to sanction the same people for multiple things, which makes us feel good, but doesn't actually do anything in terms of changing Russian behavior. And I would say you step back and you look at application of sanctions over the last 30 years, you'd be hard pressed to find many examples where they've actually worked to change any state behavior, be it North Korea, be it Iraq, be it even Iran to some extent, and certainly Russia and so forth. So we need to start thinking about other mechanisms to articulate our displeasure that actually are impactful. And of course, the reason that we use sanctions so much is they're relatively cost-free, at least vis-a-vis the actors that we tend to use them. Notice that we don't often use them against China because that would be hugely detrimental to our trade relationship with them and would actually incur economic pain on us. But the reality is we don't have much of a trade relationship with Russia or Iran or North Korea. So those are easy to sanction. And that's sort of the tool that we immediately go to once we want to do something, and you know, as the expression goes, to hammer everything looks like a nail. So let's hammer them with sanctions. But you know, we are not willing to do other things that could have more impact, but are potentially escalatory, potentially could harm our interests, and you know, inevitably would have trade-offs that no one is willing to consider.
All right. So this brings up, I think, a little bit of a paradox in your argument, in which you say basically, don't do the full response that you might be thinking of. Don't treat the Russian SolarWinds attack like it was a highly irregular thing, because it's actually pretty narrow, pretty targeted, and traditional espionage. So treat it like that, like you would a regular physical world espionage operation once uncovered, maybe arrest some people, not that there's anybody to arrest here, trade them back to the Russians, like, you know, the illegals, but don't treat it as different in kind. But then when I ask you, well, what's your this is the sledgehammer that breaks the camel's back, you're describing a pretty mundane response, which is, you know, sanctions that against people who are already sanctioned, they won't be terribly effective. So realistically, what's the difference between a sort of nuclear response from the United States to SolarWind and a, you know, the more measured response that you're thinking about?
Well, to be clear, I'm not arguing for sanctions vis-a-vis Russia, really in response to anything that they've done, because I just think that that has exhausted its usefulness and we need to consider other measures. In terms of SolarWind specifically, I think you need to take the models from the physical world. When we arrest spies from Russia or any other country, we don't just pat them on the back and say, good job, you were only doing espionage. That's within the realm of what's legitimate. We take offense. Yes, we arrest people. Obviously, no one here to arrest, but we also may, depending on the severity of the incident, throw some spies out of the country, maybe close some consulates, do things of that nature. You know, those things could be on the table here. Obviously, you have to determine if it's useful to do so, given that the Russians will inevitably reciprocate and will throw our CIA agents out and potentially close what's left of our consulates in Russia. So you really want to think hard about whether that's worth the you feeling good and showing them something. But those are the types of things that I would consider. I would not go beyond that. I certainly would not do sanctions. And the last thing I would do is actually try to lump everything together. Election interference, Navalny, the Skripal poisonings, and SolarWinds and everything else, and try to respond to all of it at once with the same approach. Because, again, if your intention is to try to change Putin's behavior and to let them know that you've really crossed the line, that, again, is counterproductive, because they will just see this as Americans doing what Americans always do, which is hammering Russia from their perspective. And, you know, they're not going to change their behavior across the board and not do any of those things. So in my view, you really need to focus on what matters the most to you. In my view, the use of chemical weapons to poison people is unconscionable in violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention. And that's the one thing that I would absolutely go very strong and go beyond sanctions against Russia to let them know that we find this unacceptable and we expect them to never, ever do this again and to actually do a verifiable destruction of their chemical weapon arsenal. But if you lump everything together, you're not going to achieve anything.
So I'm confused about what this looks like in practice. You would have a targeted response to SolarWind that doesn't address Skripal or Ukraine or election interference. It's simply in response to SolarWind, we are expelling the following people and we're asking, you know, our allies to expel three people each or something and swallow the consequences from whatever Russian response you get.
Yeah, if you think that that is proportionate to what they've done to us, and I think you can make a reasonable argument that it is, that's what you would do, and you would limit your response to that on the SolarWinds front.
And then treat the other things as discrete questions of their own.
Correct, and do them at a different time so that it doesn't look like you're lumping everything together.
So your approach to China on the Microsoft Exchange hack is very different. And so justify the more robust response to China and explain how that would differ.
There are really two phases to the Microsoft Exchange hacks, right? There was the early January, maybe as early as late December, beginning of the operation through late February, when there was just a traditional espionage operation. They weren't going necessarily after government targets, but think tanks, dissidents, and the like. And again, falls into the realm of what you would expect China to do to collect intelligence on what they perceive as threats to the regime. The change when they started hitting everyone and doing that indiscriminately and opening them up to further attacks is the thing that I would be mostly objecting here, And I think there's a communication that you can deliver to the Chinese, and I get that this is a little bit provocative, but you can privately tell them that you have endangered tens of thousands, by the latest count, as many as 80,000 still left organizations that have put these web shells on. 99% of them, you probably have zero interest in from any sort of intelligence collection purpose. We demand that you remove those web shells. It can be done easily with just, you know, a single command to each web shell to delete itself. Very easy to do. And if you don't do so, there will be severe repercussions, not necessarily in cyber, but we're going to hit you where it counts. And where it counts is mostly in the economic sphere, where, you know, we're going to put some of your major companies on the entities list by the Commerce Department, which would prohibit U.S. companies from doing business with you. And that could really impact your business in a huge way.
Why do it in the economic sphere rather than in the cultural symbolic sphere? I mean, the thing that really drives the PRC nuts is when the Dalai Lama comes to the White House, or when somebody calls the president of Taiwan. Why do we assume that the economic levers here are, once we're outside of the cyber domain, that the right approach isn't, you know, Uyghur Day at the White House, or I don't know if Tibet has a national day, but, you know, there are some real sore spots that they are very, very sensitive to and that they care a lot about. Is the right target the entities list, or is that falling into the sanctions trap in the China department?
Well, because of the amount of economic relationship and the interdependency we have, that's why I think sort of it's not quite sanctions, but sort of a different variation of sanctions with the entities list would have an effect with China that would not with Russia. But the other reason to do that is that something like that is an action that you can take so that you can then undo it later on. Let's say that you put it in place and then a week later, hopefully a few days later, the Chinese actually respond to what you've asked and remove their accesses and privately pledge to never do that again, then you can take those companies off the entities list, right? And you can de-escalate. The trouble with doing sort of a one-off gestures like you suggest of doing a Tibet Day or inviting the Dalai Lama is once you do it, there's no undoing it, right? And the Chinese don't have any incentive to continue with their, you know, good behavior, if you will, or to start doing it. So I think you actually have less leverage. But two, also philosophically, I don't love the idea that the Chinese are going to be telling us who we can call, who we can invite to the White House. If we want to invite the Dalai Lama, if the president wants to call the president of Taiwan, we should be able to do that regardless of what the Chinese think. And I don't want to tie the two issues together.
So I want to try to construct from this argument that you've made a generalizable approach to cyber-related espionage incidents from adversary authoritarian powers. It seems to me what you're saying is that as long as they're playing a targeted espionage game of, say, the type that we play, we should respond as we would to any other espionage incident, no matter how damaging the incident is. But the goal should be to incentivize staying within known rules rather than punishing or responding to countries based on the magnitude of the damage that the incident causes. Is that fair?
That's absolutely fair. In my view, this is all about enforcing norms, right? For the last 20 plus years, we've been talking in various international fora, the UN and other places, about norms that we would want to see in cyberspace. But we have not been willing to enforce those norms and hold nations accountable when they cross those red lines. And that's what it's all about, in my view. It's really making very clear what we find acceptable and not acceptable and hammering people hard, whether it's Russia or China, when they cross those red lines. In my view, SolarWinds does not, you know, merit that strong response because they did not cross a red line. They executed an operation that the U.S. intelligence community would love to execute against the Russians or the Chinese. So we should not, you know, try to establish that operation as somehow unacceptable and tie our own hands in the future.
So one reason this model works in meat space is that we have a sense of reciprocity. Yeah, the Russians run intelligence operations against us, but we run intelligence operations against them. And, you know, they get their Aldrich Ameses sometimes, but, you know, we had agents in Moscow. And so there is an understanding, first of all, that you win this round, we'll get you in the next quarter kind of thing. With cyber, first of all, there is a constant speculation that the vulnerabilities are not reciprocal, that we're much more internet dependent, we're much more wired than Russia or China, and therefore we're more sensitive to this kind of attack. But secondly, and if that hypothesis is wrong, this one is certainly right, that we're much more apt to publicize the breaches. And if SolarWinds had happened in China, they would have hushed it up. And so I guess I'm more comfortable with your formulation of this if I believe that there is some significant reciprocal action and that, you know, China has its own SolarWinds that happen roughly as regularly and roughly as in roughly as damaging a fashion than I am if I think that this is really about how hard we're going to allow ourselves to get hit over and over and over again without that sense of reciprocity. And so I guess I'm interested in your sense of whether there are, you know, when you say SolarWinds is an operation the United States would love to have conducted, I would feel better about going soft on the Russians in response and treating it like traditional espionage if we are in fact regularly conducting that sort of operation against the Russians and if that is a viable way of responding. So I guess I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
So this reminds me of a saying from one of the best SVR officers or at the time KGB officers in the Soviet Union, who was not famous and actually said that the best spies are never famous, right? Because they don't get caught. Only the bad ones get caught. And when you look at the U.S. intelligence community, the NSA, and frankly, all of our Five Eye partners, the Brits, the Canadians, the Australians, and New Zealand, they are incredibly good. They are head and shoulders better than the Russians and the Chinese in terms of their sophistication, in terms of the incredibly tailored and targeted operations that they're able to conduct. And the reason you rarely hear about them, except when it leaks through a Snowden type of disclosure, is because they very rarely get caught. So, you know, unfortunately, we can't go into the details of what they do, but, you know, your audience, presumably American audience, should sleep well at night knowing that the U.S. intelligence community is earning their hard-earned taxpayer funding by doing really exquisite operations against our adversaries and collecting intelligence in the way that would make the Russians and the Chinese salivate. You know, the difference between the two is that the Russians and the Chinese feel free to do things that we don't do, like engage in election interference or steal intellectual property theft and the like. But within the sort of acceptable norms, the narrow target space, we're way, way better than they are from everything that I've seen. So that's why I'm so concerned about looking hypocritical, quite frankly, when we would hammer Russia for SolarWinds and, you know, potentially one day our operations may come out and we would look, you know, foolish and hypocritical as a result.
And to what extent does that analysis play a role in the comfort level you have with sort of letting them get away with it? You know, you don't want to pat them on the back and say, good job, well done, guys, but you don't want to come down like a ton of bricks on them either. Is that partly because you're comfortable that in the actual battle within the confines of traditional espionage rules, we will do okay?
Yes, very, very comfortable on that front. And also, I think it's important to talk about sort of the messaging we've seen from the administration. There was a great Al Nakashima Washington Post article a few weeks ago where it quoted an unnamed official who said the reason that they feel that SolarWinds is so objectable is not because of what the Russians did, but because of what they could have done, i.e. used all this access both into government networks and others to destroy them. I find that logic very puzzling because you generally prosecute people for what they actually do, not what they might have done. And, you know, if you apply that same logic to our own operations, what happens the next time the Russians do catch us in, let's say, the Kremlin network? Well, they say this is unacceptable because you could have destroyed this network, even though we had no intention to do so. It just seems like a ridiculous line of argument.
So I want to close with a question related to your suggestion that we basically go back to the Chinese and say, hey, if you don't want big trouble, take out these web shells. There are something like 80,000 networks that this affects at this point. I can't help but notice that you're suggesting that a foreign intelligence service go back into networks it has already compromised and make further changes, albeit in this case salutary changes. Is that a precedent that we want to encourage?
You know, I think that's a great question. And I made that suggestion fully knowing that it's provocative and perhaps even legally ambiguous. You know, can the U.S. government give, you know, in fact, tacit permission to the Chinese to access networks, not just in the U.S., but globally, frankly, to do something that would be for the better good of the world in terms of saving these networks from ransomware operations? It is a good question. I think it's a question that deserves more debate. I would love for the U.S. government, frankly, to have the authority to scan, you know, at least the U.S. servers and automatically disable those web shells instead of relying on the goodwill of the Chinese to do so. Obviously, that poses numerous legal challenges as well. So I viewed that suggestion sort of as a shortcut. I am very much afraid of a ransomware wave. We're already starting to see some targeted ransomware operations against select victims. If the criminals manage to automate this and hit all 80,000 of them, including many, you know, small businesses that may really go out of business if they get hit by a devastating ransomware attack, that's the only reason why I'm pushing for something this provocative, because I do feel like the threat merits it. But it is a question that deserves more debate, including from a legal analysis perspective.
We're going to leave it there. Dmitry Alperovich, write for us more often and come back and join us on the podcast anytime.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the intrepid Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. Zachary Frank and Jen Patya Howell are doing their parts, but have you promoted the Lawfare Podcast on social media? Have you shared us on Facebook or tweeted us? Have you left us a rating or review wherever you found us? Have you gone to the Lawfare store and purchased Lawfare Podcast merch? Get on it, people. Our music is performed by the one and only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.